Hi, I'm Neil Slade, and welcome to the Tickle Your Amygdala bonus audio CD. Turn on the best part of your brain to go where you really want to go and do what you really want to do. In this 80-minute audio program, you'll be hearing excerpts from the book as well as a few excerpts from 56 interviews I conducted with people from all over the world that illustrate what the amygdala does and why it is so important to consciousness and the quality of everyone's life to tickle it. You'll be hearing a hilarious story from comedian Josh Blue, winner of the NBC hit television show Last Comic Standing. Rigorous scientific investigator Nancy Talbot will be describing her 14 years experience investigating the medium Robert Vandenbroek, who can replicate a whole gamut of incredible psychic phenomenon under the most controlled scientific conditions, including not only talking with dead people, but actually the ability to capture their images on still and video digital cameras instantly while it's happening. I'll be talking with Steven Snyder, who was the principal piano technician to world-famous musician Stevie Wonder for 10 years. Steven, who was stone-cold deaf for the first 5 years of his life and learned how to see into hyperspace, now tickles his own amygdala with a tuning fork. We'll hear from Michelle McCoskey, who helped create the very first software used on Apple and IBM personal computers, and who has practiced amygdala tickling for 15 years. Then there's world-famous psychoanthropologist Dr. Lawrence Blair, who will relate his work studying the new paradigm of broad organism quantum consciousness being proved at the molecular level by scientists, and who relates his own observations seen in his travels throughout Indonesia, such as filming John Chang, a living human electric dynamo who can create measurable electric current with his own body and set newspaper on fire with his bare hands, as well as hear about Blair's witness to remarkable creatures who share a single mind, such as the unnamed underwater slinky that can be stirred into dust with one's hands, only to reform completely and perfectly in a matter of moments. And then, finally, some comments from Terry Jones, the comic genius and film director and a founding member of Monty Python's Flying Circus. This isn't the twilight zone that you've entered, but the world of brain radar and tickling your amygdala. The first question everybody has is, why should I bother to learn what tickling the amygdala is? It's because nobody in the universe can be absolutely 100% certain of what's good for you except you. Even if you are one of a set of identical triplets, you are still a completely unique collection of experiences and desires, just like a walking, talking snowflake, of which there is not another one in any corner of the galaxy just like you. The only place that you can really find the answers to all of your unanswered questions is right smack in the middle of that mind motor that's called the human brain. Your brain. The trick is no trick at all. It's simply a matter of tuning into that magical brain radar dish that sits in the middle of your brain, that fantastic tag team of your amygdala and the most advanced part of your brain, your frontal lobes. Your amygdala and your frontal lobes operate together like a super Sherlock Holmes, guiding you towards the answer to every mystery you encounter. Together, they are a master key that will unlock every riddle that comes your way. Tickling your amygdala is without peer. It is, by its very nature, the easiest and most pleasurable way to turn on the best part of your brain. Tickle Your Amygdala shows you how. I'd like to start with a true story. When my mother was younger, she worked for Viking Press Publishing in New York City. At the time, her Aunt Mildred, a very fashion-conscious person, was the vice president of Heiress Gloves. My mother said to her one day, "Aunt Mildred, I'm working for a big publishing company now, and if you need any books, I can get anything you want at a good discount." Aunt Mildred thought about this for a moment, and then replied, "Now that you mention it, yes, I've got a new bookcase, and I can use some books. Please bring me a red one, a blue one, and a green one." So for those thinking about getting a new book, Tickle Your Amygdala has a white cover with a rainbow-colored feather on the front and will match any decor. And unlike many other books, you can actually read and enjoy it instead of using it to collect dust like so many other books you may have sitting around your house. The Tickle Your Amygdala book is divided into two main parts. The first part is a fun, simple, and quick illustrated explanation of what amygdala tickling is all about. Here, I'll be reviewing some of those main ideas on this recording. Obviously, unless you can see with your ears, you'll have to read the book to see the illustrations. The second part of the book consists of detailed explanations of what the amygdala does and why it's so important to everybody. The science behind amygdala tickling, conversations with 56 people from all over the world who help explain and define amygdala tickling, and finally, 52 ways to tickle your amygdala, some which you may like to do, and some which you may never do. You see, this is all about brain self-control. How you tickle your amygdala is strictly something you decide for yourself. I don't have the answer. Nobody does. Only you know what works best for you. I can share some stories and tell you what other people do, but in the end, tickling that fun pleasure button inside your cranium is something that you determine best for yourself. The great cosmic joke to all of this is that the amygdala and what it does has been a non-secret since amygdala started appearing in the brains of mammals over 65 million years ago. All you have to do is pay attention to it. This book is just a post-it note reminder about something your parents and your first grade teacher probably never told you about way back in grade school when you were busy gawking at pictures of Tyrannosaurus Rex. So then, onward to some real honest-to-goodness 22nd century brain magic. Imagine you have a feather inside your brain. Use it to directly tickle your brain's pleasure spot. That's one way to tickle your amygdala. Josh Blue, stand-up comedian. Josh Blue tickles his audience's amygdala every time he goes on stage. He became a household name in America as the winner of the hit NBC television show Last Comic Standing. A member of the U.S. Paralympic soccer team, he competed in Athens at the Paralympic Games, the world's second largest sporting event. He continues to tour full-time, performing live shows on stage and on television. He has several comedy CDs, a DVD, and an upcoming book to his credit. His life and story illustrate many frontal lobes' amygdala tickling principles.
Can you tell me, you know, a bit of your background and your story growing up? Where are you from originally?
I grew up in St. Paul. I was actually born in Cameroon, West Africa.
Oh, really? And,
so I think that really has influenced me as being a white African-American. But when I was 15, we moved to Senegal for a whole year. And it was my sophomore year of high school. You know, it's weird coming back from Africa and having another year, couple years of high school, you know, because I had a different perspective. And I was one of the only disabled kids in my school. It was all mainstream. So I already kind of stuck out. And like I said, I had a scribe my junior year of college. I went back to Senegal and did my independent study at a zoo. So I spent 3 months working as a zookeeper, which was totally random, but again, life-altering and life-changing. And I did something in there that I also think was a very pivotal point in my life, where I actually got them to lock me into a cage for an entire day and put myself on display.
What happened? What was that like?
Oh, I have endless stories about that. I mean, it's like, I had no shirt on, just shorts.
You got to wear shorts.
Yeah. But the thing was, is like, if you take cerebral palsy kind of out of context and put it in a cage, people think, well, what the fuck is going on? And they were, honestly, like, like, during the afternoon, there was, like, 70 people around my cage, like, the whole day, feeding me peanuts and, like, fruit and all kinds of just stuff like that. And but I shared a wall of bars with a 400-pound gorilla. So, like, I mean, that day, I mean...
What'd the gorilla think?
Well, it was cool because I had established a relationship with him. Uh-huh. Like, I became, I think, one of three people in the world who could pet him. And, like, just a beast, man. I mean, he's huge. So strong and just amazingly cool. But so we shared a wall of bars, and then basically it was his other half of his cage.
Yeah.
So how you clean the cage is you slide the door over, and you'll go in there, you put food in there,
right,
and you slide it shut, go clean that side.
Got it.
So I was on this side. And what happened was, they have like a 3-hour siesta at the zoo, where they just shut it down.
Yeah.
And they're like, you want to get out? And I was like, no, I'm gonna do the whole day in here. And everybody leaves, and I'm in.
Everyone left the zoo.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's no visitors, and all the zookeepers are eating lunch, or
right,
taking a little nap, or whatever.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting in the little concrete shelter area.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, I hear the very distinct sound of metal bending. I was like, what the f***? And I, like, look out, and the gorilla has, like, wrapped his fingers around that metal door, and is, like, prying it back to get into me. And I'm like, oh my god, people aren't going to... By the time they get here, I'll be long dead. But, and it wasn't like... I don't think he wanted to kill me. I think he just wanted to play.
Right.
So then I just was like, all right, I guess it's time to play. So, like, for 2 hours, I just ran back and forth along the bars and, like, tickled him and fed him.
To distract him from bending the bars anymore,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It wasn't the bars. It was like actually just a metal door that slides over, you know?
But so he could have come in.
I think if I had let him do it longer, he probably would have eventually... Because, I mean, I was like, eh, I heard the noise. I was like, oh, my God. And then it was just such a funny... I should let you read the story. I wrote it one time. I wrote it in college. It's one of those stories that is just so ridiculous. Because it's, like, they started calling me the boo-boo monkey. Like, the zookeepers would call me that. And then there was one zookeeper that came up front. And I always thought he didn't like me. Because he chased me one time with, like, a hedge clipper. And he was up front and center. I've been studying, like, primate behavior the whole time. So I kind of knew how they acted. And, like, if a primate doesn't want to talk to you or pay attention to you, it'll give you the coldest shoulder you've ever had. So I was like, I didn't speak at all during the time in there. And I remember there's like 70 people. And this zookeeper I thought didn't like me, he was like pretending like he was the foremost expert on the boo-boo monkey. He's like, yeah, it's from the mountains of Congo. And we captured him, you know, and like, and I'm just sitting there, because it's all in French and Wolof. And, like, I don't think the audience think I understood,
yeah,
you know, Wolof. And I could hear people's conversations in Wolof about me.
Oh.
And I'm just, like, I'm trying not to laugh. Because they're like, what is that? Like, what is that? And then there was, like, one point where, there was a woman who was, she spoke some English, and she was like, I know you understand me. And I just kept like, And then she finally said in English, I think she spoke English when she didn't speak more. She goes, you're crazy. And in Wolof, I said back, Yamaganadof, which means you're crazier than I am. And everybody laughed, like, except for her, because she didn't speak Wolof. And they're like, she's like, what did he say? What did he say? And some like English student goes, he said, you're crazier than he is. And it was just a good laugh.
That's such a great story.
And it was, I mean, it was endless. I mean, so many things that day. Like, I actually, earlier in my trip, I got malaria. I had to go to the hospital and get a shot.
Yeah.
And the doctor, I forget where he's from, somewhere in the Middle East. And I told him, well, you should bring your kids to the zoo for a visit. And of course, that's the day he came. And he sees me like in a cage. And he gave me the craziest look, like, oh my God, a shot didn't fix you or something like that. He's like, do you remember me? And I was like, symbol like shot in the butt. Like,
you made the hand sign.
Yeah.
For injection. Yeah. That's so funny.
But then I also remember like.
How old were you when this? 18?
I was
19.
No, I was probably 20.
Okay.
20. And then, to be honest with you, that was a point in my life where I go, now I can die. Like, if I died now, I could say that I've accomplished and done something that probably no one else has ever done.
Do you sometimes feel like a dog waiting for scraps, looking up at the table while the rest of the family is scarfing down a big Thanksgiving dinner? So, how are you going to get a fat piece of that pumpkin pie? Luck? Fangs? A giant supercomputer? Well, it's your lucky day. You already have the exact tool to get what you really want and need. You were born owning the most powerful tool on Earth. It is the most complex and remarkable device yet that anyone has ever discovered. This is your very own human brain. Save money, wipe your chin, and forget about that vastly overpriced and environmentally unsound $5,000 super duper liquid cooled 100 core deluxe portable combo computer cell phone washing machine can opener that you've been drooling over. You already have the most amazing and powerful doodad ever created, and it's sitting right between your very own waxy two ears. Fact. Your brain is an infinity mind motor and calculator with literally more possible connections than there are grains of sand on all of the beaches on Earth. More connections than there are stars in the sky on a clear dark night. Or for that matter, you have more possible connections in your brain than the total number of elementary particles in the universe. Literally. This, as calculated by Dr. Carl Sagan, Dr. Richard Restek, and many other scientists. By comparison, any other machine is about as oppressive as a lonely squirrel chewing on a stale, wet watermelon seed. So, what is the key to using this incredible brain machine that you have on your shoulders to figure out which way to the jackpot? It is this. Inside your personal super mind motor is a master compass that works like pure magic. It is the amygdala. The amygdala is part of a brain circuit that quickly tells you which way to go when you need to know it. It tells you via emotional feedback how to know exactly what is bad for you and also what is good for you. This brain circuit computes pleasurable emotions as reward and unpleasant emotions as deterrent. Although the amygdala responds to external cues and external things like a nice kiss or the promise of a new toy unwrapped, you can also self-stimulate your own amygdala directly and powerfully by using your own internal thoughts and behaviors. This is called tickling your amygdala. Tickling your amygdala means to observe and directly stimulate your brain's master reward pleasure circuit. You do it by using your own brain and thought processes. Imagine that. What could possibly be better than being able to directly tickle your own brain's pleasure circuits and your feel-good spot? Tickling your amygdala is easier than scratching an itch, licking your favorite flavored ice cream cone, or eating chocolate cream pie. It is like a dessert that never runs out, even when you don't have any money in your pocket. You can tickle your amygdala anytime and at any place. Unlike scratching your butt, you don't have to worry about being embarrassed that you're doing it in front of somebody that you're trying to impress. As it turns out, tickling your amygdala also turns on your brain's built-in genius problem-solving, creativity, and intelligence circuits. That's right, in the middle of your own cranium, you have the very same internal circuitry that little Albert Einstein was born with, and which he later tickled himself to write his world-famous equations. This all sounds great, but it's just pretend, right? Nope. Between 1995 and 2009, Dr. Sarah Lazar, Dr. Herbert Benson, and other researchers at the Harvard Medical School demonstrated conclusively in a number of research projects that one could instantly and positively stimulate one's amygdala with sheer thought. The results were demonstrated and recorded using functional MRI brain scanning machines and have been repeated many times by others in similar laboratory experiments. People all over the world are now reporting their ability to tickle their amygdala. Any kind of people. Smart people, silly people, professionals, unemployed workers, skateboarders, scientists, gardeners, you name it. People just like you and your mother. Michelle McCoskey was right at the start of one of the biggest revolutions on the planet, the home computer revolution. And she helped create the very first software found on Apple and IBM personal computers. But perhaps even more important is that she's been in on the beginning of an even more important revolution, the brain revolution.
All right, so I'm talking to Michelle. So again, you're in Marin County?
Marin County, yeah.
Marin County, north of San Francisco. Now, how did you first run across the amygdala or brain self-control material that I...
Okay, back in, when you were first, the first time you were on Art Bell's show?
Oh, my goodness, 1997.
Okay, that long ago, I guess. And I ordered the first two books that you had, that you put out.
That would be Brain Magic and, actually, Frontalobe Supercharge. So you actually formed a group of people that would get together and click their amygdala. What is your educational, your formal educational background and your occupational background?
Okay. I have a bachelor's degree and a master's degree from Indiana University in social sciences and literature minor, and I worked for the School of Music. I was an archivist for the Music School Library, which was a fabulous job. You would have loved it. But then I got into this computer software thing and worked with John Draper, who's known as Captain Crunch, and got out the first word processor for the Apple and the IBM.
Oh, tell me a little bit about that.
That was like the late 70s, early 80s, when you tried to call Apple, there wasn't anybody there to answer the phones.
Yeah.
And there was a group called, so we bought an Apple One, my partner and I, and...
Apple One?
Yes.
That was really the early days.
That was the early days, and we bought it at a hardware store.
Oh, my, an Apple One. Now, everyone's familiar, well, not everyone, but people are familiar with the Apple Two, which was the one that really took off, which was the very small, you know, the size of a typewriter. But you're talking about the Apple One computer now. You had
like
Steve Jobs and Wozniak's fingerprints on the Apple One, probably.
Probably. And the person that we... And I've met all those guys.
Oh, you have? Really?
Yeah.
Oh, this is going to be a long conversation. I can tell already.
You want a story of the peripheral of all kinds of energetics out there, but... The 70s in San Francisco were quite bizarre.
Hey, man, did you hang out with the Grateful Dead, man?
A little bit. And I have one of my friends in Bolinas is a big Grateful Dead hangout with. And I do know Jerry Garcia's, I don't know, Mountain Girl, the one who was married
I know
Ken Kesey.
Yeah, you were friends with Mountain Girl? So I've got to ask you before we get too far away. So how did you, why did you run into Wozniak and Jobs? How did you end up with an Apple One? That's basically the question.
How did I end up with Apple One? Okay, it's karma, basically.
Okay.
One of my ancestors crossed the Delaware with George Washington, and he was a general and a governor. And
oh, you know, I have a painting of George Washington crossing the Delaware that my grand...
He's one standing up. Both sides of my family were basically kind of teachers and farmers, and then they were beyond the bankers and then be masons, except not those kind of Illuminati masons.
Right.
You know, regular people that knew how to do things.
Yes.
So anyway, I think that always, like in the 60s, you know, we were beatnik hippies and trying everything out and taking LSD and, you know, doing all that stuff.
Ooh.
And, you know, and sort of, well, oh, okay, I can tell you this. When I was about 4.5 years old, I lived, and my father was killed in World War II, so my mother and I lived with my grandparents for a while, her parents. And we lived there in this little town north of Indianapolis, and I looked outside. I was on the front porch, and I saw these people coming down out of the sky, and it was three people, a man, two men, and a woman.
How old was this? How old were you?
I was before I was five.
Okay. So they were just, they were floating down from the sky, as it were?
Kind of like they were on an escalator that you couldn't see.
Okay.
So it kind of had, it was not amorphous, but it was,
Well, I can picture that.
They were coming down into this kind of, there was kind of a big grassy field across the street, and they were dressed in what, and I thought they were Jesus, Mary, and Joseph with his coat of many colors.
Uh-huh.
That's who I thought they were.
Yeah.
And but I thought they were a bit scary, and I didn't want to go with them.
Well, if I saw some people coming down out of the sky, I would be a bit, I would be scared out of my pants, actually.
So, anyway, they, and they were kind of wearing clothes that you'd think were, like, natural colored linen robey kind of clothes.
Yeah, like more, like you might see people from the Bible, perhaps.
I guess.
Yeah.
And so I...
They weren't wearing three-piece suits.
No, and they weren't dressed up fancy or anything.
Yeah.
They came down, and they came toward the house, and I hid behind the refrigerator, and they came into the house looking for me, but my grandmother was in the backyard hanging up clothes or something, and they came over, and they made a mark. The woman made a mark on a little chair. You know how little kids have a chair and table. And then she came back in, and then they left, and I kind of looked, and they went back up, and they were gone. Now, I have no idea if they did anything. I mean, all I know is that I saw those people, and I saw someone else, too, later, but that...
Did you go look at the...
Since I was that old, I knew reality was bigger than what everybody said it was.
Did you go look at the chair and the mark that they left on the chair?
And the mark was there for years, and I showed it to my little friends when we moved. Me and my mother got married again, and we moved to Indianapolis. And
what was the mark?
It was just like a kind of an oval, a dark mark.
Huh.
Just it wasn't like a symbol or anything.
It was just like a...
It was a mark that you couldn't... It wasn't a crayon mark or anything. It was just a black sort of circle, oval. It was an oval. And I showed it to my friends who came to visit me about 10 years ago here where I live now. I hadn't seen them in years. And they lived in New York City. And they remembered the story, and they remembered seeing the mark. So
wow.
The whole thing happened, whatever it was that happened. And then another time I saw someone appear in my room, and I thought it was Abe Lincoln's first wife. Now, I don't know how a four-year-old knows that Abe Lincoln had a first wife, but he did have a first wife.
Uh-huh.
And she told me something like, don't put your shoes on the edge of the bed. Well, I've never figured that out. So, you know, I mean, it's like surrealism has always been involved, too.
All right. So you haven't been diagnosed with any sort of mental...
No. I'm extremely competent. I'm on the...
You have a college degree, so we know you're not crazy, right?
right. Well, I'm not crazy, but now I just know they were some kind of energetic information that I still can't quite figure out.
Well, even if they were just hallucinations, they're pretty damn good hallucinations, you know?
Exactly. That's what I was saying. And so anyway, so these visions were just like real. I mean, they were like a reality. Okay, so did you ever hear of Captain Crunch?
No, I haven't.
He was a phone freak person, And he was friends with them, and that's how I ever, well.
Oh, well, their first project was building the little black box to make free long-distance phone calls.
I actually have one somewhere, built just by those guys.
Right. Yeah, they made like 100 of those and were selling it, and then they realized, hey, we can make money building little devices with buttons.
Yeah.
And that led to the first Apple computer.
Yeah. My partner, Matthew, and I bought the first Apple. They had a group called the Apple Corps, and about 12 people showed up, and it was Wozniak, and I guess Jobs came, but and Draper, and then we got hooked up with Draper, and then that's how we ended up being starting a little corporation, and I was like the business and logistics person. Draper wrote the code for the first word processor that they sold for the Apple that was available for the Apple.
Okay.
And that was called Easy Writer.
Oh, right, right, right. So that was the software that was used on the Apple computer.
Yeah.
So your group kind of put that together.
Yeah, and that was separate. But Jobs just couldn't stand Draper because he was so uncivilized. But Wozniak and Draper always got along. And Wozniak is sort of the heartful person in the group.
Yeah.
The other person, their other friend, competitor, what's his name? Bill Gates.
Bill Gates.
He was around. They were all around in the late 70s, early 80s.
Did you have some contact with Gates personally?
Well, I've rubbed elbows with him, yeah.
Yeah.
Didn't know he would be one of the richest men in the world. So, uh-huh. I mean, it's an odd, when I think about all this stuff, you know, you go through your life and you're doing whatever it is you're doing every day, playing with the dogs and the cat, you know, and then you start remembering, that person's the richest person in the world. Oh, yeah, I rubbed elbows with him. But I wasn't, those computer guys were so geeky that basically the conversation was always, and then you can do this, and then you can do that. And it was how to make it all work, engineering-wise.
Yeah.
My technology is brain.
Okay.
That we can keep ourselves warm, we can keep ourselves cool, we can keep ourselves healthy, because we have instrument.
Right, you're not as attached to those tools and circuit boards. You're using the circuit board that's between your two ears.
Exactly, and that's why I like clicking the amygdala.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, if you look at the brain and compare that with any computer, the brain just runs circles around anything. The brain made the computers.
Exactly.
So the computers are just a little tiny slice of what the brain is capable of computing. And we're still learning. I mean, we'll always be learning what the human brain is capable of. It's the infinity machine.
Yeah.
Hard drive will never say full.
Right, right. Yeah. That's right, yeah.
All right.
But there is not just one way to tickle your amygdala. You will discover how to tickle your amygdala in your very own way. When you do it, you'll know it. You'll smile and even at times fall over laughing because it's so simple to do. Brain Radar. When you tickle your amygdala, you automatically turn on Brain Radar. Brain Radar is the application of whole brain power, a powerful combination of logic and reason combined with extraordinary intuitive perception. Brain Radar provides you with seemingly magical but completely real means for arriving at the right place at the right time with the right solution. Brain Radar is like always having a magic wand in your pocket, except that it's not make-believe. It comes from a real understanding of how your brain works and how to access the infinite potential in yourself. Popping your frontal lobes. Regular amygdala tickling will eventually allow you to pop your frontal lobes. We're all familiar with popping chewing gum or popping your eardrums on a plane. Believe it or not, the brain is actually capable of more than that. Popping your frontal lobes is like hitting the brain jackpot. It is the astonishing sudden peak, eureka, moment of great significance, discovery, solution, understanding, and overwhelmingly positive emotion that far eclipses normal experience. you are at last licking that big ice cream cone in the sky. Just think for a second and remember a time when suddenly all of the pieces fit together, when you finally got it, what you had been looking for all that time. Now you can pop your frontal lobes and make it happen again, and again, and again. You no longer have to tolerate every moment as if you are bored out of your skull, as if you are doomed to clean out your cat box for eternity. Instead, you can choose to tickle your amygdala, turn on brain radar, and pop your frontal lobes in a big way, and get that big piece of pie that you've been drooling over and that's been out of reach for so long. Science has now demonstrated that the biggest and smartest part of your brain is also the most fun and pleasurable to use. It's right there, waiting to be tickled by you 25 hours every day. It's as easy as, well, pie. Anything else is just an accident. You can solve your problems and get what you really want as a result of your own easy and predictable method of tickling your amygdala instead of stumbling around in the dark with your fingers crossed. Or, if you prefer, you could put a sack over your head and continue to enjoy banging it against the wall until the cows come home. Which do you prefer? A lot of people hear this and think, well, so if your brain is so great, what's the problem? I have a brain and none of that's happening. Well, haven't you ever looked all over the house for something only to finally find that it was under your nose the whole time? Human brains are funny that way. Don't worry, you can now tickle your amygdala and find what you've been missing all along. Some people say, you don't need a brain. You don't need to know anything about it. No need to think. Well, this is true. In 1792, the French discovered that one could solve all possible problems by removing the brain and then throwing it away. They liked the guillotine. This worked for many, especially those who found their brain to be a bothersome inconvenience and an inferior organ of the body. So, if you are one of those people, please give this book away to somebody else or use it in your compost pile. However, if you are open to an alternative possibility or the idea that your brain is somewhat useful, please keep listening and reading. Survival and happiness means getting to chocolate cream pie, or whatever it is that you need to stay alive and find meaning. If you don't like chocolate, then banana or lemon custard is okay. Life is a line indicating forward energy of you moving towards the pie or the pie moving towards you. When life works right and you are going in the right direction, it feels good. When things go wrong and you are going in the wrong direction, it feels bad. It feels good to go forward towards something good. It feels bad to go hungry towards zilch. You can know exactly which direction you are going before you get there, by how you feel inside your brain. You see, inside your brain there is a master compass. This is your amygdala. The amygdala is an emotional compass that tells you if you are going in the right direction. The amygdala does this with emotions. You actually have two of them, two amygdala, one for each side of your brain, for each hemisphere of your brain. It's located behind each eye and about 1 inch inside from the top of your ear. We call it amygdala singular because they both basically do the same thing, one for each hemisphere of your brain. Your amygdala has memorized from experience and knowledge what feels good and what is good for you. It has also learned what feels bad and what is bad for you. It provides a lightning-fast brain shortcut that works faster than you can say, "Give me a piece of dat pie!" Some people invent their own ways to tickle their amygdala, like Steven Snyder. Steven was the principal piano technician for world-famous musician Stevie Wonder for 10 years. Steven regulated and tuned pianos at Carnegie Hall, Lincoln Center, and all the major New York recording studios for the greatest music stars in the world. His story is perhaps not so much about tuning a musical instrument, but more about tuning the human brain.
Testing, one, two. Hi, Steven?
Yeah, Neil.
Yes, okay. So this isn't entirely professional because I'm eating a grilled cheese sandwich as we speak.
It's fine.
Why don't you give me a rundown again of your, you know, what you do and your kind of previous occupation and current occupation?
What do I do? I mean, I tune and repair pianos.
Mm-hmm.
I rebuild them. I'm pretty much considered an expert regulator. I don't know if you know what that term means.
Yeah, I do. Do you adjust the touch and the app and the feel of a piano keys, right?
Yeah.
That's what
yeah.
a regulator is.
Yeah, I adjust all the action parts and adjust the aftertouch and make it so that it has the best tone possible out of that particular instrument.
What is it? What's the training to learn how to do that consist of? How long does that take?
My father was a piano technician.
Your father was?
Yeah, so he taught me a lot, and then I studied with other really top-notch regulators throughout my career. I mean, I started tuning when I was a kid and worked my way through college tuning, and then, like I told you, I worked for Steinway in New York in the 70s when I graduated from BU. And
when you graduated from where?
Boston University.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I graduated from BU in 75 and moved to New York and started tuning for Steinway in the mid to late 70s.
So you were not your average piano tuner.
I don't know what average is, but...
To blow your own horn.
These guys are, you know, the average tuner is somebody who is... bought a piano tuning machine and bought a few tools and printed up some business cards.
Right.
About your average tuner.
Well, what I'm saying is you've got to be pretty good at your job to work for Steinway.
Yeah. Essentially, you do. Yeah, I'm pretty much considered an expert in the field, I would say.
Okay. And plus, I mean, you're 59 now, so you've been doing this for, almost 50 years.
Yeah, my whole life, uh-huh.
Yeah. Now, you also mentioned that you had worked for Stevie Wonder. Tell me that story a little bit.
I had, when I was tuning at Steinway in New York, Stevie had his recording studios on 8th Ave in New York City, and I tuned his pianos, at that recording studio, and he was getting ready to move his whole operation to L.A. So he tried all the piano tuners in New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles, and he liked my tunings the best. So he, you know, offered to set me up and help me get established in Los Angeles if I'd move, and so I did.
Now, what is even more remarkable was that you told me you were deaf. You were completely deaf for the first 9 years of your life?
First five?
Was it total deafness?
Total, yeah. I had overgrown tonsils and adenoids, and what that did was it caused my hearing canals to fill with fluid, and it sealed out sound. The tympanic membranes couldn't vibrate, and I couldn't hear a thing. And often when... if I lived in the Middle Ages, I guess, you know, I'd still be deaf.
Right.
But the problem was discovered, and it just took a simple operation to correct it. But when you're when someone has one of their senses that is lessened, like I couldn't hear, then often nature compensates with heightening the another sense, so that in my case, the lack of hearing, nature compensated for that by developing my eyesight, where I started to be able to see what people call the invisible, enter the invisible. I could see the material world, and then I started to see hyperspace and parallel realities and all the beings living in those other realities. And this isn't all that unusual, because I think a lot of children see these realities, and what happens is, you know, they say, well, you know, I have this invisible friend, but then they're made fun of, and culture drums it out of them, so they learn to deny that aspect of themselves, and they shut it off and don't allow it to develop naturally. But in my case, since I wasn't talking and I couldn't hear anything, the most active environment for me to put my focus on was hyperspace and parallel realities and the beings that live there. Those beings telepathically communicated with me and pretty much started giving me my education right then and there on the nature of reality and what kind of world we live in and what human beings are here doing and who they were and what different body types live in that reality and those dimensions. And so that was, for the first 5 years of my life, those were the beings I interacted with.
I'm only asking this because I want to know what your experience with a tickling your amygdala or clicking your amygdala would be. When did you first run across my book or my website that gave you...
I ordered your book about a year ago.
Okay. So,
I've been
so,
working with it intensely ever since.
So you have been tickling or clicking your amygdala forward using some of those techniques, or no?
Everyone that I could possibly do. I like I do it pretty much every day, and I've incorporated it into my daily routine. I mean, like for me, one thing I experiment with is I've got a tuning fork that is the frequency of 520. I don't know if you're familiar with that frequency. It's a frequency that Dr. Horowitz came up with from the Sufalgio scale, musical scale. Every morning I'll use that tuning fork and I'll put it on each spot on my forehead where the amygdala should be and seek to have that aid in clicking the amygdala forward. I'm placing it two places. I'm placing it right on the top of my head and then right on in the frontal lobes.
Okay.
I'm doing it in both places at different times. You know, one place.
Well, what do you experience when you use your tuning fork to stimulate your frontal lobes and you're thinking in terms of that amygdala, you know, clicking technique for yourself? What kind of experiences have you had over the past year, and have they changed, or is it the same? And, you know, maybe relate a little bit what your experience is. I'm guessing that you've noticed some result, or you probably wouldn't keep doing it.
Yeah, I would think that it gets my brain and my whole being more focused in that area of as a key switch, like you say, to more brain usage. And I think there's a real connection between working with gratitude and love and the amygdala flipping to the frontal lobes.
Mm-hmm.
I think that this whole connection here between the heart and the prefrontal lobes is something that's profound, and that it for me, in my experience, they work together. And so that if the heart is functioning with the prefrontal lobes in a greater capacity, then there's more of a chance that I could have coherent thinking. instead of reactionary survival type thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have noticed that as I've worked with it, my thinking has become more coherent, and it's been easier for me to just stay coming from the heart rather than being reactive and coming from the reptilian brain, which is how we're all trained and how I was trained too, and how I used to be.
The amygdala uses emotional magnetics to indicate life direction towards or away from chocolate pie and other good things you want in life. A good job, a good mate, a good time. Did you ever wonder why some things make you feel good and why other things make you feel bad? Here's the reason. Positive, pleasurable emotions attract us to those things that keep us alive. Negative displeasure emotions repel us away from things that threaten our survival. This is just like how a compass needle is attracted to cute, playful polar bear cubs in the North Pole and points away from squawky penguins in the South Pole. Your amygdala's feeling bad emotions show life direction away from pie. Bad emotions and your amygdala give you yuck. Your amygdala's feeling bad emotions show life direction away from pie. Amygdala gives you yuck. Amygdala bite is when the amygdala flashes a red feel bad signal. Stop! Danger ahead! Forward life direction automatically puts on the brakes with an amygdala bite. When your direction is away from chocolate cream pie, life flow is reduced. You're going in the wrong direction. Your amygdala gets bitten and you feel bad. This is like being sent to your bedroom without dessert. When your amygdala gets bitten, you feel like you're going down the drain. When something bites an amygdala, people have been known to explode, drive a car off a cliff, hide under the bed, cry a pool of tears. When your amygdala points down and backward, life sucks. This is like having no pie and you're still hungry. Do you ever feel like you're going in the wrong direction? Do you ever feel like your amygdala is getting bitten?
Ow!
Do you wish you had a dependable compass inside your brain that you could follow that would help you go in the right direction and keep from getting bitten? Surprise! You do have a compass inside your brain. The only problem is that you may not have always correctly been reading your compass. Maybe you don't even know that you have a compass.
Huh?
Or that you have an amygdala.
Huh?
That's all. Dr. Lawrence Blair's astounding travels through Indonesia have been well documented in his many films, such as Ring of Fire and Myths, Magic, and Monsters. He has made his home in Bali for the past several decades. Tickle Your Amygdala looks at his experience with healer John Chang, who has demonstrated the ability to create electricity or ki energy with his body, to the degree that he can set newspaper on fire with his bare hands, drive ordinary bamboo chopsticks through solid planks of wood, and light electric bulbs held in his fingers. Not tricks, but rigorously examined abilities that astonish those scientists who have witnessed this. In the short interview excerpt from the book, Blair talks about the new paradigm of collective consciousness.
You know, roughly the book is about the human mind and brain, and
how we have an effect on our perception and on reality by how we think. You've seen so many interesting things, especially in that regard, in your travels, in that reality is not necessarily what people may think it is. And John Chang was John Chang was quite an example of that. And many people are familiar of the documentary film clips existing of that.
My present interest at the moment is paradigm shift, the psychology of paradigm shifts. And there's no doubt about it in my mind that we have been on the brink of a paradigm shift. We're already moving into one, which makes the previous ones look like Mickey Mouse. Paradigm shift, as you know, I mean, is a fundamental change in the ground of meaning and belief, which is collectively shared by the world. And each time a paradigm shift occurs, it is a major stress on our psychology, because we have to abandon grounds of our previous meanings and beliefs. It has directly to do with consciousness, and there is a strong argument for the fact that people are realizing that consciousness is not at all confined to human beings, but is through nature and matter in a way that we have previously not suspected. And to make a long story short, it will be having to do, this new paradigm shift, with how consciousness actually shapes the physical world. And there is quite a lot of data to support this from various fields, not only in neurophysiology and the psychology of perception, but in the earth biological sciences.
The new paradigm shift seems to be shaping up every bit as psychologically difficult for us to digest as were previous paradigm shifts to the psychology of our ancestors. We look back on things like, let's say, the heliocentric system going down, you know, Copernicus and Galileo.
Exactly what I was thinking of.
A far greater one than that is occurring in the area of consciousness, which is the consciousness that is permeating all nature, physical, you know, not only organic nature, but arguably at the subatomic level. And there are many fascinating examples of this. For instance, things like emergent behavior, where you have great groups or flocks of birds or fish that begin to behave like a single organism. Things like the extraordinary Asian synchronous gregarious fireflies, which are a colony of fireflies that ignite and occlude at precisely the same instant, their own individual colony rhythm, so that they can light up a whole mangrove swamp like a flashing Christmas tree, which has led some biologists to say, well, maybe this is a broader organism just reflected by individual discrete parts. In my latest series called Myths, Magic and Monsters for Sky TV, something else here that we filmed, which looks like a slinky in the water. Do you remember those sort of springs that walk downstairs?
Yes, of course.
That we had as kids?
I've got one in the other room.
Okay, well, it's about the same size as that, except it has a skin on it, and it is moving along a front and a back and an underneath and a forward digestive and an anterior excretive part. And you can beat it up with your hand underwater, and the whole thing just disintegrates into a cloud of dust. But as you watch, that cloud of dust reintegrates itself back into a single organism again, sometimes including some of the detritus or matter on the bottom of the sea with it, and it's, within moments, carries on walking and behaving like a single organism.
Oh, and these are...
It's a colony, if you look at it under a microscope, but it's a great mystery because, okay, each little part of it has a positive and a negative end, a back and a front, but how do they know where to conglomerate and be a specialized organs in this overall organism?
That's quite incredible. What is the name of this creature?
It doesn't have a name yet.
Oh, that's...
It doesn't have a name. They're very rare, and they're only just being discovered off New Guinea.
That's quite incredible.
Well, these are three rather special examples that I have from my own work, and I use in this and that and the other, but there are many others which are suggesting there's a paradigm shift, particularly in the area of quantum physics, where we think that a certain consciousness is operating at the subatomic level. In fact, it may be that there's nothing but consciousness. All the rest of this is an illusion.
Feeling good emotions show energy direction towards pi. Amygdala gives you yum. Positive emotions attract us towards those things that help us. Your amygdala's emotional magnetics automatically attract you towards helpful-looking things. That's very handy, and it feels good. This advanced positive brain signal is an amygdala tickle. Amygdala tickle is when the amygdala shows a green feel-good signal. Go forward. Life direction flows forward. Amygdala tickle. When your direction is towards chocolate cream pie, life is going in the right direction, you feel good, and your amygdala is being tickled. Your compass is indicating you are going the right way. So, in summary, the overall quality of your life depends upon what your amygdala compass says about your relative position to chocolate cream pie. To review quickly here, if you are getting an amygdala bite, ow! You are going in the wrong direction and life sucks. If you are getting an amygdala tickle,
nice.
You are going in the right direction and life is delicious. The old obsolete notion that no gain without pain is just flat wrong. Brain research and common sense tells us that this is a lie. But aha, you say, not everything that feels good is good for me. How about eating lots and lots of candy? That gives me a stomach ache. Well, of course it gives you a stomach ache. If it doesn't feel good, it's not good for you. You have to consider everything, the big picture. Not just what is immediately right in front of you. When you learn how to really read your amygdala compass and then tickle your amygdala, you learn how to see more than 1 inch in front of your nose. And then you don't get any more tummy aches. Your amygdala is also connected to the most advanced part of your brain. The biggest single part of your brain, the frontal lobes. Your frontal lobes are flexible and nimble, yet powerful. Your frontal lobes can make a quart of lemonade out of any bunch of lemons. Your frontal lobes can solve any puzzle that comes your way. Instead of just reacting to things with the primitive reptile portion of your brain, your frontal lobes compute creativity, imagination, cooperation, intuition, and logic. Nancy Talbot is president of the BLT Research Team, Incorporated, a nonprofit professional U.S. research group consisting of multiple credentialed scientific consultants and a number of field workers. The BLT Research Team's purpose is in the discovery, scientific documentation, and evaluation of physical changes induced in plants, soils, and other materials sampled or recovered from crop circle sites worldwide. Additionally, in this short excerpt from her complete 6-page interview in the Tickle Your Amygdala book, Talbot describes the nature of consciousness regarding her 14 years' experience investigating the medium Robert Vandenbroek, who can replicate a whole gamut of incredible psychic phenomenon under the most controlled scientific conditions, including not only talking with dead people, but actually the ability to capture their images on still and video digital cameras instantly while he's doing it.
With Robert, what I have become absolutely positive of is that consciousness, but consciousness of some kind, I have no doubt is involved now. I have absolutely no doubt whatsoever. And if you read through the Robert reports, I put exactly the events that I have experienced. And when you have had enough of these events, which I now have so many, you get to the point where you know it cannot be coincidence. It cannot be just an accident that such and such happened. There is a consciousness of some kind, and I don't know whether it's Robert's consciousness somehow or other being projected, whether it's mine, whether it's the collective unconscious, whether it's angels, ETs, gods, the devil, I don't know. It's something, you know, it feels to me to be external to me. And Robert says absolutely flatly, it is an external cosmic spiritual energy. That's what he says and absolutely believes.
My observation in the research for this book points to two ways of looking at consciousness. One, I like to call the little me-I, which is the typical egotistical self-centered, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but I mean the way in which we look at the world through our own eyes as individuals. And I call that the little me-I, as it were. But then what I've observed is there is this other level of consciousness, which I call the big magic I, and I spell I with the capital letter I, which is a quantum consciousness, which is a term that some people have used, which is a collective consciousness, which is brains connected together, which is minds beyond what is the individual experience. And so
Jung called the collective unconscious.
Exactly. Yes. And it is
definitely that possibility, as far as I'm concerned. It's also quite possible that it's what Miss Robert, you know, cosmic spiritual consciousness, or that it's angels, or that it's God, or that it's ETs, or that it's interdimensional, some sort of interdimensional reality. Robert often speaks of that. I mean, I don't know how to delineate between these things. I have no way to do it, so I can't identify that part. But the fact that there is a consciousness completely aware of, in this case, me and Robert, I know this. It has made itself, you know, known to us repeatedly so many times that I can no longer say to myself, oh my God, that was a weird coincidence. It's like, whatever it is listening, it understands both Dutch and English, and periodically it reflects its presence so clearly that you can't believe it. It's like, oh my God, but it does. And I tell people, I write what happens down. I don't interpret it for them because I don't know how to, but I tell them exactly what the hell happened when we get these weird pictures, and I explain exactly what was going on when the pictures occurred, what we were talking about, what the question was that was just raised, and then boom, then the pictures come, and the answer's in the pictures. And it happens all the time for us. And it happens much too often to be coincidence. Now, maybe Robert is somehow projecting his consciousness. It isn't mine, I'm sure of that. He says it's not his, although, you know, I don't know that because I'm not in his head. But whatever it is, it clearly understands these nuances that you have to be a relatively sophisticated individual human to understand. And it understands them, and it then just reflects in the photographs, the images that it chooses to create. It reflects back to us its awareness at that instant of us. It's quite an experience.
Yes, I understand what you're saying. It is this whole other level of reality, as it were, that we can recognize as individuals, but it goes far beyond what we are as individual persons with a little package of awareness inside our brain.
We're all connected.
Yes.
The sooner we get that through our thick heads, the sooner we behave in a much more intelligent fashion. It seems that the purpose is that, or the hope is that eventually the brain perceives that it doesn't have to be on guard all the time, at least with certain things, and it can open up and flower and grow and become open its access to the larger universe. And that's what I think these movements you see all over the place. I mean, they, you know, some of them call themselves, oh, they have a million different names, you know, wisdom seekers and spirit seekers, and there's a lot of people using different methodologies. Some of them use yoga, some of them use meditation, whatever. They're all trying to do the same thing, which is to get themselves into this place where they can open up and learn more about the larger reality. And the crop circles are just one way to do that. They are one offering by the big kahuna in the sky. You know, they're one, come on, let's play. Let's pay, come on, play. Get involved, this is fun. And they do it by doing all these pretty things in the field, which don't scare you. I mean, some other sort of Bigfoot would scare me.
Yeah.
UFOs scare a lot of people, and they might me too in certain situations. But crop circles, sitting there in the field, just sitting there, they're not doing anything. And people can go and enjoy them on a beautiful day. You know, it's a totally different kind of experience to introduce you to this idea that there is a larger reality. It's the very most gentle and elegant way that I think whatever it is that's out there has come up with to encourage people to take the next step.
You can tickle your amygdala at any time using your frontal lobes, CECL, creativity, imagination, cooperation, intuition, and logic. No matter what is happening outside of your brain, instead of being controlled by stuff that happens to happen, you can tickle your amygdala to feel good. Here's how it works. Your frontal lobes can instantly change and rotate the direction your amygdala compass is pointing, from bad direction to good direction. 1. The amygdala is hardwired in the brain to bite when you are going the wrong way, and to tickle when you are going the right way. 2. Your frontal lobes can see which direction your amygdala compass is pointing by evaluating your emotional magnetic direction, positive or negative emotion. 3. If you are pointing the wrong way, your frontal lobes allows you to intelligently adjust your interior and exterior direction, no matter what else is going on around you. 4. You realign with the life direction and face in the direction of survival and happiness and go that way by changing your direction. You make lemonade out of lemons. You see the glass half full. You whistle while you work. You follow your bliss. You powder your armpits. Your amygdala gets tickled. Instead of just watching your amygdala twirl and spin at random like a tornado on a crummy one-channel reptile brain TV set, your advanced frontal lobes allow you to tune into any station on the infinity dial. You can pick out a much better program anytime you wish with your frontal lobes. Everybody tickles their amygdala in their own unique way. Although it's easy to imagine a feather tickling your amygdala to turn on more frontal lobes' brain power and go in the right direction, like a supercharged V12 engine, you can use your frontal lobes' sense of humor. Terry Jones, one of the founding members of Monty Python's Flying Circus, talked to me directly about the importance of tuning in to the amygdala's pleasure feedback, something that comes second nature when you finally understand that your amygdala guides you to your goal with enjoyment.
First of all, I want to say that I've been the greatest admirer of yours since I was a teenager watching Python in my mother's kitchen many, many long years ago. And you've been a great influence on my own work. So I can't tell you how pleased and honored I am that you've agreed to
take some of your valuable time to speak with me on the subject of the human brain and human potential as you see it.
Yeah. So what do you do exactly?
Well, I'm an author, and I write books on brain and behavior science for the layman.
Right.
And I've been a teacher for some 35 years.
Yeah.
And so first of all, I want to start out with a question that I'm sure my readers would like to know your feelings on. I want to know, do you prefer a powder or a liquid to get your socks clean and to get your whites their whitest white?
A powder or a liquid? Well, I think neither, really, because you can't write if you're under the influence of anything, I don't think.
Oh, I see. Oh, all right. Well, that answers that question. You've had a great deal of success critically, artistically, and I'll assume to some degree financially and materially, and probably socially as well. As you look back on your experiences in life, for you, what stands out as being most important and valuable to you among all of these measures of success that society defines?
I think it's just enjoying what you do, really. I mean, for me, it's a great joy to actually to write. I know Douglas Adams hated writing. He just feared it and was always behind on his deadlines. And he was a friend of mine. A thing called the Starship Titanic.
Yes, I'm familiar with that.
Yeah, well, what happened was that Simon & Schuster had given him $2 million to produce something, and he hadn't done it 7 years later. He still hadn't done it, and so he said, could he get away with doing a video game of it? And they said, all right, but then they decided they wanted to have a book as well. They commissioned one of the science fiction writers from the 60s to do it, and Douglas hated it, and I just read his film treatment for the, it was about 20 pages, and he said, would I be interested in writing the book for him? And it was such great fun. I mean, it was one of the most enjoyable things. It was just like when you see people writing on film. We had 5 weeks to go, and I did it in 3 weeks, just working in the morning, and it was just a lovely thing to do. And then time never passes so quickly as it does when it's really working.
So it sounds like you're saying enjoying your work is what you value most.
It's such a blessing to be able to enjoy your work, really, yeah.
This is the end of this Tickle Your Amygdala bonus audio. Now enjoy the rest of the book with all of the 56 interviews, the science, the stories, the jokes, and the 52 ways you can get started doing it yourself. Then you'll decide or invent your very own favorite way to tickle your amygdala. It's the easiest thing you'll ever do. It's as natural as breathing and as simple as brushing a feather across your head. You can do it anytime, any place, no matter what else is happening, and turn on the best part of your brain to go where you really want to go and do what you really want to do. Anybody can do it, whether you're 5 years old or 105. It costs nothing and takes only a second or two. Tickling your amygdala supercharges anything else you do. The results are cumulative and get better and better as you go along. So, what are you waiting for? Please visit brainradar.com. Music on this disc by Neil Slade and Fred Poindexter. Read by Neil Slade.